had become as important, as indispensable, as a part of their bodies. Taking it away would be like amputating a leg. Some in town, most of them black, worried about what might happen to him if it somehow didn't work out, what the incredible effect of that absence might be. They saw something potentially dangerous in it all, and some in town, all of them white, gleefully suggested that Booby Miles, without the ability to carry a football in his hand, might as well get a broom and start preparing for his other destiny in life, learning how to sweep the corners of storerooms. On other occasions, some whites offered another suggestion for Booby's life if he no longer had football. Just do to him what a trainer did to a horse that had pulled up lame at the track. Just take out a gun and shoot him to put him out of the misery of a life that no longer had any value. What would Booby be without football? Echoed a Permian coach when asked the question one day. The answer was obvious, as clear as night and day. Black and white in Odessa, Texas, and he responded without the slightest hesitation. A big old dumb nigger. Part 3. The scrimmage ended. Under the glow of the stadium lights, Ivory Christian helped Booby adjust to a pair of crutches that was too small for him. It was a beautiful night in Lubbock, windless, in the 70s. Jones Stadium, home of Texas Tech University, was virtually empty, and there was a mood of serenity and peace. The light falling on the field accentuated the colors, the green of the artificial turf, the red of the seats, like a luscious flower bed. Everything looked wonderfully vivid and clean as Booby struggled with the crutches to get off the field.
"Take care of yourself, man, so me and you go to the same college," said Clifton Monroe, a running back from the opposing team.
Booby smiled that wonderful glowing smile. He liked hearing that. But an instant later came the fear of not being able to go to college at all.
"That's what I'm afraid of," he said.
Gaines huddled the team around him. He tried to be stoic, giving the familiar speech that no team was ever built around one player. But the thought of a serious injury to Booby gnawed at him. He had been preparing for this season the moment the last one had ended 8 months earlier. He was methodical and meticulous about everything. The kind of coach, the kind of man who prepared for every possible situation through tireless work. And now came something he had no control over. Booby's loss was just the kind of news he didn't want to hear. An omen that the season was tailspinning out of control, somehow jinxed. If the knee was wrecked, there went the team's star before a single down had even been played. And who could possibly take his place? Who could match the physical skill of Booby? On the bus ride home, he hardly said a word to anyone. The gray shadows of Brownfield and Seagraves and Seminole and Andrews falling across his face like a fine mist. Instead, he leaned against a railing right behind the bus driver, gazing at the highway through the bug-splattered windshield, lost in thought, the tension of a season that hadn't even started yet, reducing him to silence. The next day, Booby came to the field house with a huge smile creasing his face. A doctor's exam had showed it was more a sprained ligament than anything else. The doctor told him he could play again in 10 to 14 days. Booby might only miss 2 or 3 games of the season. But then, almost as abruptly, the dream changed again. A second examination by another doctor did reveal damage to the knee. Booby needed arthroscopic surgery. He would be out at least a month before he could come back, and there were some, like Trapper, who believed the road back might take much longer than that.
"It's not an impossibility that Booby can come back. Can he mentally overcome the injury to come back? Can he be full speed? You have surgery on your knee. They cut it open, and then they say, 'Fuck, you're okay, go back out there.' It's kind of a gut check. Do you really want to play football? Can you really come back from it?
It meant adjusting to a knee brace. It meant not flinching an inch when the knee was hit full speed by a helmet, not succumbing to the perpetual fear of pain, not running with the slightest tentativeness, which was the edge between a great player and a mediocre one. And it meant doing all these things at the age of 18. In the aftermath of that meaningless scrimmage in the summer twilight in Lubbock, Trapper envisioned a definite fate for the booby Miles who had been the dazzling jewel of the watermelon feed.
I think he's just gonna drift away.
With the season opener a week away, the pressure now intensified on everyone else, on Brian Chavez, with his metamorphic ruthlessness, and Ivory Christian, with his love-hate ambivalence, and Jared McDougal, with his religious zeal. If Permian was to go to state, they would have to perform in ways that no one had ever imagined, rise to heights beyond even the expectations of the fans. But no one would have to have a greater year, be more superb than Mike Winchell at quarterback. Now, more than ever, it was up to him. The Season. Chapter 4, Dreaming of Heroes, Part 1. When his father gazed at him from the hospital bed with those sad eyes that had drawn so narrow from the drinking and the smoking and the endless heartache, Mike Winchell had been 13 years old. He knew something was wrong because of the way his father acted with him, peaceful in the knowledge he didn't have to put up a fight anymore. Mike tried to joke with him, as he always had, but Billy Winchell didn't have time for playful banter. He was serious now, and he wanted Mike to listen. He brought up Little League and warned Mike that the pitchers were going to get better now, and the home runs wouldn't come as easily as they once had. He told him he had to go to college. There could be no two ways about it. He let him know it was okay to have a little beer every now and then because the Winchells were, after all, German, and Germans loved their beer. But he admonished him to never, ever try drugs, and he told his son he loved him. He didn't say much more after that. The arthritis eating into his hips and the agony of the oil field accident that had cost him his leg too much for him now. In the early morning silence of that hospital room in Odessa, he let go. Mike ran out of the room when it happened, wanting to be by himself, to get as far away as he possibly could, and his older brother, Joe Bill, made no attempt to stop him. He knew Mike would be back because he had always been that kind of kid, quiet, loyal, unfailingly steady. Mike didn't go very far. He stopped in front of the fountain at the hospital entrance and sat by himself. It was 1 a.m. and hardly anything stirred in those wide downtown streets. He cried a little, but he knew he would be all right because ever since the split-up of his parents when he was 5, he had pretty much raised himself. Typically, he didn't worry about himself. He worried about his grandmother. But he didn't want to stay in Odessa anymore. It was too ugly for him, and the land itself bore no secrets nor ever inspired the imagination, so damn flat, as he later put it, that a car ran down the highway and never disappeared. He longed for lakes and trees and hills, for serene places where he could take walks by himself. Mike came back to the hospital after 30 minutes.
You were the most special thing in his life, his brother told him. It's a hard pill to swallow, but you're going to have to make him proud of you.
As for leaving Odessa to come live with him, Joe Bill gently talked Mike out of it. He used the most powerful pull there was for a 13-year-old boy living in Odessa, really the only one that gave a kid something to dream about, the power of Permian football.
He talked about how Mike had always wanted to wear the black and white, and how much he would regret it if he didn't, because there were so few places that could offer the same sense of allegiance and tradition. Mike knew that Joe Bill was right. He had already carried that dream for a long time, and despite what he thought of Odessa, it was impossible to let go. He stayed in Odessa, and sometimes when he went over to his grandmother's house and talked about his father, it helped him through the pain of knowing that Billy was gone forever. "His daddy worshipped him," said Julia Winchell. "He sure loved that little boy." And Mike returned that love. "When he died, I just thought that the best person in the world had just died. Billy and Mike." There was Mike, smiling, curly-haired, looking into his dad's face at Christmas time. And there was Billy, thin and wizened and slightly hunched, like a walking stick that had warped in the rain. There was Mike at the flea markets they went to together on Saturdays and Sundays over on University, helping his father lift the boxes from the car and set them in the little booth. There was Billy following him to a chair so he could sit and rest. There they were together on those hot afternoons that Mike hated so much but never complained about, selling the cheap tools and knives and toys and Spanish Bibles that had been found in catalogs or on trips to Mexico. There was Mike playing Little League Baseball with that go-to-hell stance of his, feet close together, up on the toes, taking as big a stride as he could possibly muster into the ball, jacking one homer after another. And there was Billy, the proud master, watching his gifted disciple from the car, unable to get out because of the pain in his leg and the arthritis. Under the demanding tutelage of his father, Mike could do no wrong in Little League. He became the stuff of legend, with 27 pitches in a row thrown for strikes, a single season in which he hit 30 home runs. And then, somewhere around the time his father started slipping, Mike lost that innate confidence in himself. The gift was always there, but he began to question it, doubt it, brood over it. When he hit 3 homers in a game once, he didn't go back to the bench feeling exalted. "Why in the hell can I hit these home runs?" he asked himself. "Why could I do it when other kids couldn't?" There had always been something inward and painfully shy about Mike, but the death of his father forced him to grow up even faster than he already had. He knew Billy was in pain, and he also knew that only death could stop it. "It was hurting him, and there was nothing they could do," he said. "You don't want nobody to die, but you don't want him hurting all the time either." After Billy died, Mike's life didn't get any easier. He had a brother who was sent to prison for stealing. At home, he lived with his mother, who worked at a service station convenience store as a clerk. They didn't have much money. His mother was enormously quiet and reserved, almost like a phantom. Coach Gaines, who spent almost as much time dealing with parents as he did with the players, had never met her. Mike himself almost never talked of his mother, and he was reluctant to let people into his home, apparently because of its condition. "He never wants me to come in," said his girlfriend, Deanne. "He never wants me to be inside, ever." When they got together, it was over at his grandmother's, and that's where his yard sign was, announcing to the world that he was a Permian football player. Me and him talked about not having a nice home or a nice car, and how those things were not important, said Joe Bell. I told him, "You make your grades and stay in sports, you'll one day have those things." Mike persevered, a coach's dream, who worked hard and became a gifted student of the game of football, just as he had in baseball with his father. The one ceaseless complaint was that he thought too much. And he knew that was true, that whenever he threw the ball, he didn't just wing it, go with his instincts, but sometimes seemed to agonize over it. A checklist racing through his mind, even as he backpedaled. Be careful. Get the right touch now. Watch the wrist. Watch the wrist. Don't overthrow it now. Don't throw an interception.
He started at quarterback his junior year at Permian, but his own obvious lack of confidence caused some of his teammates to lose faith in him in a tight game. When the pressure was off and the score wasn't close, it was hard to find a better quarterback. When the pressure was on, though, something seemed to unravel inside him. But now he was a senior and had had a whole year to process the incredible feeling of walking into a stadium and seeing 20,000 fans expecting the world from him. He seemed ready. Ready for something truly wonderful to happen to him. He didn't dwell much on his father's death anymore. It had been 4 years since it happened, and Mike had moved on since then. But he still thought about him from time to time, and he said he had never met anyone more honest or more clever or more dependable. He smiled as he talked about what a good horse trader Billy was, and how he loved animals, and how he had bought him every piece of sports equipment that had ever been invented. When he had had trouble with his baseball swing, he knew that Billy would have been able to fix it in a second, standing with him, showing him where to place his hands, jiggering his stance just a tad here and a tad there, doing all the things only a dad could do to make a swing level again and keep a baseball flying forever. And Mike also knew how much Billy Winchell would have cherished seeing him on this September night, dressed in the immaculate black and white of the Permian Panthers, moments away from playing out the dream that had kept him in Odessa. The 2-a-days in the August heat were over now. The watermelon feet had come and gone, and so had the preseason scrimmage. Now came the Friday night lights. Now it was showtime in the first game of the season. Most everyone thought that Billy Winchell had given up on himself by the time he died, but they also knew that if there was anything making him hold on, it was Mike. Billy and Mike.
He would have liked to have lived for Mike's sake, said Julia Winchell. He sure would have been proud of him.
Some of you haven't played before, been in the spotlight, said assistant coach Tam Hollingshead in those waning hours before Permian would take the field against El Paso Austin. He knew what the jitters of the season opener could do, how the most talented kid could come unglued in the sea of all those lights and those thousands of fans. He offered some succinct advice. Have some fun, hustle your ass, and stick the hell out of them. It's not a party we're going to. It's a business trip, Mike Ballou told the running backs. If you get hurt, that's fine. You're hurt. But if you get a lick and you're going to lay there and whine about it, you don't belong on the field anyway. The team left the field house and made its way to the stadium in a caravan of yellow school buses. They went through their pregame warm-ups with methodical, meticulous determination. Then they went to the dressing room and sat in silence before Gaines called the team to huddle around him. He didn't say much. He didn't have to. Everyone knew what was at stake, that if all went without a hitch, the game would be the beginning of a glorious stretch that wouldn't end until the afternoon of December 17th with a state championship trophy. It would be a 16-game season, longer than that of any college team in America, and as long as most of the pro teams' seasons. 3.5 months of pure devotion to football, where nothing else mattered, nothing else made a difference. That 1988 season is 4.5 minutes away, Gaines said quietly, with a little smile still on his lips. Let's have a great one. At the very sight of the team at the edge of the stadium, hundreds of elementary school kids started squealing in delight. They wore imitation cheerleading costumes and sweatshirts that said Permian Panthers number one. They began yelling the war cry of Mojo, Mojo, Mojo in frantic unison, rocking their arms back and forth. A little girl in glasses put her hand to her mouth as if she had seen something incredible, and it made her momentarily speechless between screams. As the black wave of the